lot of time talking to Price, and I got the impression you really liked him. You think he's going to figure out a way out of this? You know, to what Evan was saying, he really beats himself up after games, even games when he's pitched well, and he'll talk about how badly he pitched and he's got to be better and this pitch was awful, that pitch was awful, and he gave up three runs. And I think he came to Boston feeling, you know, seeing what happened to other prominent players who came here and thinking, I think he's trying too hard almost to be accountable, and he's trying to be like sort of the anti-Carl Crawford.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think he really cares what you think, and that's part of the problem. I tell him, go to Cambridge. Don't want to know who the hell you are. It'll be good.
So we are very happy to be joined tonight by a pretty good chunk of the Red Sox beat writer crew. All the way at the end is my Globe colleague, Alex Speer. Next to Alex is Evan Drellich from the Boston Herald, back covering the Red Sox after a few years in Houston. Jim McCaffrey from Mass Live. And my close personal friend, Dan Shaughnessy of the Boston Globe. No booing. There can be no booing. All right, so we've all covered the Red Sox for various amounts of time. Dan was very good friends with Tris Speaker and Jimmy Fox back when he started covering the team. The rest of us have covered more recently, but it's a very interesting job in a lot of ways, and one of the things we thought we would at least start out talking about, because I think there's some misconceptions about it, is a little bit what our schedule is like, because our schedule is a little crazy. Evan, why don't you kind of explain to the folks about what time we get to the park and what is it we do well before first pitch at 7:10?
Yeah, I think people like have a conception that you get there, you know, maybe 6 o'clock before a game. No, you got to be at the park for a night game at 2:30, 3 o'clock at the latest. Some people, like Pete, are really diligent and show up at, you know, maybe even 2 o'clock. Yeah. How much time do you think we spend a day with the manager? Like, total time as a media? Just like, shout it out. Yeah, 5 to 10 minutes, right? You listen to talk radio, they say it sounds like it's a lot more, but no, we're barely with him at any point in time. It's a pregame press conference. It's a lot of standing around in a clubhouse waiting for players. It's kind of trying to track somebody down. You come to the park with one idea, and you're trying to see if you can execute. And these guys at home, particularly, are rarely around. So it's a lot of scampering around and just trying to find whoever it is you're looking for and hoping that you can get a unique angle. And then you're constantly writing the rest of the way. You got to do your running game story, which you file at the end of the game. Then you got to do an update after that. And it's a lot. I'm not saying it's overly difficult, but it is kind of a wild and longer day than I think people realize.
Dan, how much do you think the gig has changed since your early days covering Baltimore?
Some of the things, I mean, you guys work a lot harder than we did, and we worked hard. It's a young man's job, young woman's job too, and it's long hours. The tweeting, the blogging, the posting the lineup as soon as it's there, the immediacy of it has just changed the dynamic a lot. I don't think you guys know the players as well as we did because we live with them, we travel with them, hotels, airplanes, buses. Wasn't always good, but we knew them and we could tell the fans what they were like because there was so much closeness and availability. And even if it was bad, we knew them. There's less worrying about the other team. In our day, you had to go to the other side and see what they were up to, and hardly anyone does that now. We'll have four guys at a Sox game, and we don't send anyone to the other side because you don't want to miss anything on our side, and that's really all of our readers care about. So those things are part of it, but I just think it's a lot harder. I do some of the beat work in spring training for you guys. This guy's a beast, by the way. He can do everything, 1,000 hours a day. I just can't believe it. And it just wears me out. So I would say it's a lot harder now.
Jen, as somebody who does a lot of social media, how much, we all write our stories. How much writing on social media do you think you do over the course of a game day?
Yeah, I think, like Dan was saying, I think that's one of the biggest things that's sort of changed this this era of sports media and kind of interacting with the fan, doing things like this, but also just kind of back in the day, the only way a fan could get in touch with a beat writer was to send them a letter in the mail, and then you might get a response. Nowadays, it's more or less our responsibility, at least where I work, to interact with fans in our comments section, whether good or bad. You have to kind of pick what you want to address. You have to have a pretty thick skin. I'm sure all of us can tell stories about that. But you're tweeting pre-game, middle of game, things that you think the fan might find interesting, post-game, obviously, any kind of news. And I'm on a mini vacation right now, and kind of, you know, when they make a trade, I kind of feel the obligation to tweet out a few things about that too. So I feel like social media has become one of the biggest changes, I think, of the job, from even 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, and if I could interject off of that, with the getting a letter a few days later after you wrote something. It used to be if you did a Sunday game, you didn't suck until Wednesday when the mail came in. And you know, and now you suck before you leave the press box. I mean, they're already on it. It's good.
Alex, from the way you've covered baseball, you know, looking at some of the, you know, away from the game things to report about, how much do you think just the reporting on the game itself has changed in the last, 5 years or so?
Drastically. And I think that, it is often discussed in our circles about the game story being a lost art, that, this was this seminal thing that was like the centerpiece of the pride of a newspaper, the pride of a writer, that they were able to describe the action on the field in a way that was incredibly compelling. Part of the reason being that a lot of the reading audience hadn't seen it. And so now I operate largely with the assumption that I'm supplementing what you're doing, right? You write great game stories. A lot of your daily focus is going to be on writing that game story. None of my focus is going to be on the game story. I may take one small morsel of a game and use that as the point of departure for what I do. But my assumption is that either A, everyone has read it, has seen the game, or B, they have read someone else who has written about the game, and so I can be kind of this complementary aspect to it. And so, it's important, unless I become redundant, particularly at the Globe, where we have great coverage of the game story, of the beat, unless I'm doing something that's distinct from those elements.
I remember in my first year of covering baseball, I started doing a blog on the Yankees. It was like the first time anybody in New York had tried doing that. And I think my dad, who's here, actually was the only person who read it for several days. And I couldn't figure out what to do. You know, this thing wasn't working out so well. And they put the lineup up one day in spring training, and I thought, oh, I'll put the lineup, on the blog. Maybe that'll work. And I came back an hour later, and there were 50 comments, everybody complaining about the Yankee lineup in spring training. And I think, you guys will probably hate me for this. I think I'm the guy responsible for these stupid lineup things. We have to get the lineup up immediately because everybody has to know who's playing second base. And somehow that just clicked. That became a thing. People wanted to know the lineup. And when I started out, you had to describe, this is how the first run scored and this is how the second run scored. Now people can pick up their phone and see what pitch the guy hit and on what count and where it went and what's his career record against that pitcher, by the time the ball lands in the outfield. So there's not much value anymore in describing how every run scored. But, today my story was mostly all about Stephen Wright, and that's the way we kind of go about covering baseball has changed so much. But I think to Alex's point, whatever it is you want to read about baseball, I think there's so many different ways and places that you can find it. And I think in Boston, whether it's the Herald or the Globe, Mass Live, all of the different people we have who cover the Red Sox, you can get a whole lot of different ways and opinions and analysis about the Red Sox. And I think if you're a Sox fan, you have a pretty good selection of ways to learn about your team. So I think the next thing we wanted to talk about is David Price, who's confounding. He leads the league in strikeouts. And yet he has the worst ERA of his career. He's given up almost the most home runs of his career at this point in the season. It's you can look at it and say, geez, he's been pretty good. And you can look at it and say, geez, he's been awful. Jen, how do you look at David Price and where do you see this going in the second half?
Yeah, obviously from most of our perspectives, this isn't where we thought that he would be at this point, especially for a $217 million guy that they acquired in the offseason. You always kind of look back at track records and that's, over the course of his career, he's been able to kind of shut guys down, especially in the American League East. I know Hazen was saying earlier about kind of coming into Fenway, but, Price has been there before. And you kind of, as a writer, we're trying to hold these guys accountable for the fans and kind of, you know, also understanding that he is coming in kind of a new setting and kind of learning how to, you know, work through his adjustments with a new team and new coaches and new teammates and that kind of thing. Some guys do it easier than others. He's been traded a few times throughout his career. But then again, you know he pitched in Tampa for such a long time. Obviously, that's where he was drafted and kind of came up through. So you do obviously expect a lot more from him at this point. And, you know, I can only go back and kind of rely on that track record to say that he's got to turn something around at some point. Maybe this is one of those outlier off years that starters tend to have. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I'll jump in. I'm as puzzled as everyone, right? Like that incredible disparity between the ERA, right? The kind of bottom line of ERA, and granted, I understand that ERA isn't the be-all end-all, but it's a pretty significant indicator. And guys who have the stuff to strike out so many batters, and this is an elite, 10 plus strikeouts per nine innings pitcher. So I looked at the history of guys who had, who had a strikeout an inning in the first half of the season with a kind of crappy ERA, and what happened to them in the second half of the season. And it turned out that since 2000, there were like a dozen of those guys, and maybe 10 of them enjoyed marked improvements in the second half, which is kind of what you would expect, because the number of people who have the stuff to strike out that many guys is so rare that you would expect them to be way better than what David Price has been. But I offer the caveat, which is that I don't think that it's just, I don't think it's entirely random that he's giving up all of these home runs. I think that baseball is entering into an era in which mistakes are more vulnerable than ever, and opposing hitters are swinging from the heels in order to club them 450 feet. These are young players. It is becoming a younger and younger and younger game with guys who have been trained to hit 95 if it's poorly located. And so every one of those mistakes that David Price is leaving over the gut of the plate is going to, there's a much larger, I think, percentage of those that's going to find its way into the seats now that he's at Fenway, now that the players have been trained in the way that they are, than there have been in his past career.
All right, Evan, I'm going to put you on the spot. Give me what number will David Price's ERA start with when the season's over?
Number?
Yeah, well, a final number. Will it be a four, a five, a three?
No, three.
What do you think?
It'll be three.
A three?
Yeah. And I think I think there's a misperception with Price, and Alex is starting to touch on it. He's been a tough luck loser in a lot of games, and there's this idea, well, he's the ace. He's got to win these games. He's got to pitch well enough to beat the other team. But the reality is, if the offense isn't there, the offense isn't there. So being critical of him after a game where, yeah, he's a losing pitcher, but he struck out 10 and walked one, just we've seen this happen more than once recently. To me, I don't agree with it. There are people at my own outlet and in other outlets who would take a different stance. But he's also very self-critical. You hear him after his last start saying, I've got to be better, I've got to be better. Dude, you can't be that much better than that, right? And the problem is the home runs. He is allowing way too many pitches over the middle. We did see a little dip in velocity, which can't help. There's no way that that's a benefit to him. But you would expect things to normalize a little bit for him, particularly if he can control the home run. I think that's really you boil it down. That's it. He's got to limit the long balls.
Dan, in spring training, you spent a lot of time talking to Price, and I got the impression you really liked him. You think he's going to figure out a way out of this?
I do. I would sign him again in a heartbeat, and it hasn't been. We haven't seen that dominance that he came into Fenway with the other teams all those years. Does he have a single game with zero runs?
No.
That's unbelievable to me. I mean, with his stuff, there's not one game at the All-Star break where he allowed zero runs. I mean, because
he's got one more start.
I mean, we lived through Clemens and Pedro, and I mean, that's got to happen. I know he had a 2-1 loss, a 3-2 loss, all that. I mean, Josh Beckett's ERA was over 5 his first year with the Sox, and he was embarrassed by that. And then the next year, they won the World Series, and he delivered it. So I'm not down on him. I think it's going to get better, and I'll be shocked if it doesn't. My only concern with him, he's a little too thoughtful for baseball. Don't think you're hurting the team. I think he thinks too much.
What Evan was saying, he really beats himself up after games, even games when he's pitched well, and he'll talk about how badly he pitched and he's got to be better and this pitch was awful, that pitch was awful, and he gave up 3 runs. And I think he came to Boston feeling, seeing what happened to other prominent players who came here and thinking, I think he's trying too hard almost to be accountable, and he's trying to be like sort of the anti-Carl Crawford.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think he really cares what you think, and that's part of the problem. I tell him, go to Cambridge. Don't want to know who the hell you are. It'll be good.
All right, now here's a, we were talking about backstage, what we, you know, what would be some interesting topics here with the Sox, and obviously Mr. Ortiz is a guy who's had such a great season, and I think this is a question you could talk about all day and not come up with a good answer, so let's try to do it. Can a designated hitter, can David Ortiz be the MVP of the American League, a guy who's, I don't think, owns a glove this year? He's not going to put on a glove. He hasn't played one inning in the field, and they have no plans to do it. Can this guy be the MVP? Would you vote for him as the MVP? Evan, what do you think about that?
Is Dave Cameron still here? I think he'll judge me. No, I don't think so. I think we have enough of a understanding of value and defense, and I think a designated hitter should be in the Hall of Fame. But I don't think you'll reach a point, maybe outside of a Bonds-esque season, which we're probably not going to see again for reasons that we don't have to go into. That he should end up being the most valuable player in the league. And even with the ambiguous definition that the BBWA instructs people to vote for MVP with.
Jen, what do you think? Would you, if you had a vote on MVP, would you consider a designated hitter like David?
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with Evan. I mean, especially considering, you know, we have this advent of defensive statistics that have kind of grown over the past year, how we've seen you know, Jackie Bradley and how much he contributed with defensive runs saved, you know, over the past couple years, since 2014, really, and just kind of how much that impacts the game. David has won a lot of games or, you know, contributed to that clutch hit that's helped them. But I you know, he definitely is the most valuable offensive player. But to say that, you know, a guy like a Mike Trout, when you're comparing them, it would be hard to kind of pick between the two of them.
Alex, let me throw you this puzzle. Let's say the Red Sox win the AL East. They win, say, 92 games. They have a very good second half. David drives in 135 runs, hits 37 home runs. Would you consider him as an MVP candidate?
Would I? Probably not. But I think that there's a very legitimate chance that he could win. And I think that, look, I mean, Miguel Cabrera sucks defensively. Miguel Cabrera won the MVP. He's won multiple MVPs. And it's because people pay attention to bats. And honestly, I think that DHs are undervalued by the media. I think that they're undervalued. By a lot of different measures. I think that, you know, if you have a huge competitive advantage at one position on the field, you're made a lot better by whoever is giving you that one competitive advantage. If David Ortiz is worth like three crappy DHs for some other team, and the Yankees' black hole is like the Yankees' like failure to have a professional hitter as a DH is the difference between them and the Red Sox winning those 92 games, I think that we undervalue a great skill. And I think that if a pitcher can win the MVP, then a DH should damn well be able to win an MVP. And I think that, like, the idea that we just dismiss that, look, I understand fully the whole body of work that a Xander Bogaerts or a Mookie Betts contributes. I think that they are incredible, extraordinary players. But I do think that we cannot simply dismiss, even though I would probably look at them as more valuable players than Ortiz, I certainly would not dismiss the idea that he has a chance to be even more valuable.
You know what strikes me is when I fill out my scorecard every day, how many teams, their DH is hitting seventh or eighth, or it's a guy who's a backup infielder who they've given somebody else a day off or whatever it may be. And it's amazing to me how few teams have an actual, you know, run-producing DH. And Dan, you're a guy with, you know, has talked about the Hall of Fame with DHs and things like that. Would you consider a DH for an MVP vote?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have no problem. His numbers, he's top five at halftime here at the All-Star break, in my view. And the guy's knocked in like 66 runs. He's hitting 338, whatever. I mean, he is such a factor in every game. And where they are, I would absolutely have him in the top five, and I would have no problem. I think, like, Cabrera's a really good analogy. I mean, he didn't help any other way than hitting that year, and he won the Triple Crown. So I think, yeah, I would consider, no question.
This could be the mending of fences with you and David.
I don't know. It's a long way to go there. You know.
I feel like a member of the UN here, bringing, you know, guys together. This is great.
It's true, man.
The only thing I'd interject, basically, it's a discussion of what do you qualify as MVP, right? We're getting into, is it just statistically the most valuable guy? I don't see a way at the end of the year that Ortiz ends up being, with the metrics we have publicly available, the best player out there. Now, I voted for Josh Donaldson last year, and that was very tough. And I thought statistically it was close enough with Trout that the narrative, I believe, that applied to the season. Some people don't believe that. But that's what it comes down to, right? You know, comparing it to other DHs, well, okay, fine, but then do you want to look at it in the prism of was he simply better than every other player in the league, and how do you define that? So,
well, I voted for Josh Donaldson too, so there you go. All right. All right, well, let's. I think we're going to take some questions here. I cannot
right.
see where the mic is, but...
Over to your right.
Oh, here we go. All right.
A question about being on the Red Sox beat. I know somebody who works for a respected national site, but because of it being on the blogosphere, he's not able to get credentialed on the regular basis at Fenway Park that print reporters can be. Whereas when he goes to Colorado, Baltimore, it's no problem. Do you guys ever take a step back and look at just, you know, the beast that was, you know, created and is now the Boston Red Sox in terms of just popularity and demand? And when you go into other towns on road trips, are you ever shocked and surprised at just how the relationship between the media relations staff and the press is so much more different? It seems like in Colorado, the media relations people chase the press instead of vice versa.
Well, in terms of the access question, which is a good one, and it's one that I think a lot of teams wrestle with, part of the issue at Fenway Park is there are a lot of, I guess, quote-unquote traditional media who cover the team. And in other markets, there are plenty of places now where only one newspaper and MLB.com actually covered a team on a daily basis. So they're happy to have anybody who wants to come into the press box. And the other part of Fenway Park is they don't have as large a press box. Fenway doesn't have as large a press box physically as some other places do, you know, Yankee Stadium being one. So sometimes it's a question of space. That there's, you know, just nowhere to put them. But in terms of, you know, this is a question I think, you know, I mean, Jen only writes online. And it's, you know, it's not like it's just newspaper people. I think it's changed. But part of it is I think individual teams need to figure out where they're getting the most bang for their buck in terms of filling seats. And I think that's an individual case-by-case basis for every team.
I mean, I covered the Astros for 2 years, and they were coming off, when I got there, they were coming off the 51-111 season. They could not have been more irrelevant. They weren't even on TV. It was, and look, they were letting, it was an easier credentialing process, and it made sense. They needed publicity. They wanted attention. They wanted to be out there. And now things have turned around for them a bit, but you know, I've kind of seen the other side of it and lived in that market, and there's no way around it. It's not as overall passionate a baseball market. There are certainly passionate baseball fans as there are in every city, but this is a very unique place, along with, you know, New York and probably Chicago.
I remember when we went, you know, John Farrell does his pregame press conference at 4:15 or 4:20 every day, and there's how many of us in that room? Probably 30 people, something like that. I remember talking to the beat writer of the Milwaukee Journal, who covers the Brewers, and I said, well, what time does is your manager's press conference? And he says, whatever time you want to walk into his office and ask him a question. And that's basically what it was. And he would just walk in there and sit down and ask what he wanted, and you know, that was it. So it really does depend on the market that you're talking about. So where's our next question here? Over here?
Thank you. This is probably a question for Dan more than anyone else. Should the Cubs win this year, and having been a card-carrying member of the Fellowship of the Miserable for as many years as I have been, that when we won in 2003, we managed to survive and get through we managed to get through it. Do that. What do you think it will mean for Cubs fans, for Chicago as a city, and will they ever equal the notoriety that the Bears have?
No, absolutely. If the Cubs win the World Series, they'll be bigger than the Bears. I mean, we saw this in 2004, which in my view is still, it was a biblical moment. It was the greatest sports story ever told because they did it at the expense of the Yankees coming down from 3-0. I mean, something that never happened before. So all those things converged in one place. The Cubs they're sitting on 108 years. And, you know, the unintended consequence of this is Theo Epstein, you know, his ticket to the Hall of Fame is punched. If you're the guy that won in Boston and then went in Chicago, I mean, to do 86 years and then 108 years, you know, the National League playoffs are going to be a bear. It's really a hard thing. So as great as they are, you got the Giants, the Nationals, the Mets, who knows? It's going to be tough. But yeah, if they get there, it's going to be huge.
Pity the White Sox, by the way, who like went 1917 to 2005.
It's like it didn't even happen.
Yeah, no one gives a damn. In the same town.
Yeah, I know. It was amazing.
All right, where's our next question? We've had some good ones so far.
In the middle here?
Yep.
Hi. Are you on? You're on.
You're good.
Awesome. You know, the internet is an amazing, wonderful cesspool. And it tends sometimes to, and this question is somewhat for Jen, but also it tends to react rather strongly when women have opinions, particularly in fields that have been dominated by men, like sports writing. So it's a two-part question. Part one for Jen, I'm certainly interested in hearing about your experiences and how Red Sox Nation has been about that. But also, because we're not exactly out there harassing ourselves, for the guys, what are you doing to combat that culture?
Sure. You do get a lot of flack, I guess, is one of the nicer ways to put it, from fans that don't necessarily like what you have to say just because you are a woman. I have encountered that. I think you kind of have to, with any of us, we all get criticized for everything that we write and every opinion that we have. I think you have to find the fans that you can have an educated conversation with. You can tell right away when someone is going to start nitpicking at something that you're not going to waste your time on. So you do have to, whether you're a woman or a man or whatever, you have to have thick skin in this business to begin with, just to be kind of doing the job itself of, kind of asking players and managers tough questions after tough losses and things like that, but also interacting with fans when you tell them things they don't want to hear. Or, they might just be irrational and say things to you that you don't want to hear. You kind of have to block a lot of that out. So it definitely comes with the territory, and you kind of have to learn what to, you definitely learn how to handle a lot of that as you've been through it more.
Yeah, I'll put my shit up against yours anytime. And your worst stuff would be love letters for me, But it's really a valid question because, in truth, I think for a woman, it's way worse, the stuff that it's another level that comes to it, and it's unfortunate. It's the beauty of anonymity for those sending it. But yes, I it's absolutely true. It's worse for women.
It's from a outsider perspective from Jen. Like, I don't look at Jen's Twitter mentions. I probably wouldn't enjoy it if I did. I do remember there was a relatively prominent analyst who, when Jessica Mendoza, who's with ESPN and taken a lot of criticism from a lot of people, including local radio people here, when she took the job, there was someone who criticized her for not being, acting too much like she had been on the field, as though she had been there. This is someone who, by the way, who has made an entire career off of doing that exact same thing. And a lot of people that night, including myself, went after this person on Twitter, and that person blocked me, and, good riddance, like, who cares? So when you have when you see it very publicly, there's a chance to react, but, I don't see Jen's emails, I probably don't want to.
It's honestly, like, as someone who believes that that our industry lacks sufficient diversity, lacks sufficient representation of society, like, it's something that I struggle with a lot, and yet I don't have any answers to it. I consider, I want to do everything in my power to, to understand the need to, to create an environment of decency. I mean, it's not just, gender becomes a fault line. There's a homophobia fault line on social media. There are racist fault lines on social media. And it's all, like, honestly repulsive in terms of what one values from a societal standpoint. when it comes to colleagues, it becomes even more personal, and it becomes even more deeply offensive in a way that you want to combat it, and yet, like, in social, like, there are no consequences for people who are just jerks on social media, and it's a constantly troubling phenomenon for me, and something that, you know, something that I wrestle with asking myself, like, oh, do I block them? Well, who gives a damn if you block them? They won't care if they're blocked. So it's upsetting. It's part of a broader conversation about how to create a culture of decency when it comes to not just sports, but social media. And I think that we're all wrestling with that question in ways that vastly exceed coverage of the Boston Red Sox.
What umbrella does curly-haired boyfriend come under? You know, I can't tell. You know.
I think your question is a good one, and I'm under no misconception that I can change anything beyond my immediate circle. But the Globe has two summer interns this year who happen to be women, and one of them really enjoys baseball and I think wants to be involved in baseball media. And I think all I can do is encourage her and give her any tips that I can and make sure she has my email address before she goes on to her next job and say, hey, if there's anything I can do, if you know, there's a question I can answer, let me know. And the only way we can combat it, I think, is to keep giving people jobs. And eventually, whether you like it or not, you know, you're going to have to read people who have great knowledge and great opinions. And people who aren't pleased that they're women, you know, that's too bad, because that's where you're going to have to get your information. And it shouldn't matter. And if somebody's a great writer, why would it matter? I don't, you know, I think Susan Slusher at the San Francisco Chronicle, for my money, is the best beat writer in the country. And I've never, you know, thought she's the best woman beat writer in the country. She's a great beat writer. And I think anybody who loves baseball and loves reading about baseball, I mean, God help you if that matters. I mean, that's ridiculous.
And so, for the record, the Boston Globe now has zero women in the sports department. Five have taken the buyouts. We lost Nancy Marapiece. We lost Emily Benjamin. We lost Colleen Shearer Springer. We are down to zero. But we would happily hire one if John Henry will let us.
I was going to say, it's not by choice. It was taken them out. I would like to point out that I did not say that. All right, where's our next question coming from? Over here.
Hi, I'd like to kind of walk through the breaking of a story, whether it be either a big thing like a free agency signing or even just someone hitting the DL. How does it work its way from the team to you guys and then out to the public?
Well, if you're actually breaking it, it's not coming from the team. It's probably coming from an agent or somebody that you know within the team who's giving you the information. You're not breaking it, quote-unquote, from anybody official with the team. And I think these days, all of us probably care more about who's breaking it than all of you, because by the time you find it out, it's probably passed through a bunch of different hands. So it's not, back in the day, you could get a story in the newspaper and sit on it for 12 hours and be pretty confident sometimes that you'd be the only one who'd have it. Now you can't sit on it for 12 seconds. And I think sometimes it leads to mistakes. I know it has with me. Sometimes I think you try to be too quick and you're not as accurate as you should be. How much has the social media thing kind of impacted the way you try to break stories? I know for me it's a difficult thing.
I assume many of you go to MLBTradeRumors.com, right? And that's basically the industry clearinghouse. I had the assistant GM with the Astros tell me, David Stern, he's now the GM of the Brewers, that he never read my stuff unless it was on Trade Rumors. And Trade Rumors is kind of, that's where the credit is given, right? And it all comes from Twitter. Twitter is the medium by which all news is broken, so that's where we all go first. Ideally, you have time to put at least a link so that your website might get a click or two if my website even loads for you properly. But it's Twitter-driven, and yeah, I think Pete's right that we probably count it more than anybody else does.
There's already a tweet from tonight's event. Maloney Investments, we love you. That's very good.
Alex, in your job, breaking news is not necessarily, you know, what your main focus is on a given day, but when you do have something that you think is original or newsy, is it more, do you value expediency or kind of writing a more complete story about it?
That is a tough question that I wrestle with constantly. You know, there's a question of whether or not you develop a story properly versus offering information in these like tiny little morsels and then potentially having more substantive answers offered elsewhere. I don't have a good answer. I try to stay in dialogue with my editors. I still have yet to come up with a good answer, aside from kind of wrestling with this question of the weird thing that is, if you report news and break it on Twitter, then, you know, then it's never yours. And it doesn't belong to you or your outlet. It belongs to the world. And, you know, the art of breaking news as a valuable art form, I think in many ways is also a lost one, save for those people who exist solely on Twitter. You know, there are the people who, you know, whose jobs, like, you know, John Heyman, God bless him, is like, you know, has made like a second career of just breaking news on Twitter, like, you know, 140 characters at a time. And I don't know, like, I don't know if that's beneficial to his outlets. It's certainly beneficial to him, right, in many ways. Like, he's really, really good at it, so that's not to denigrate him, but I don't have a good answer to that. Do you?
No, I hate sometimes that I feel like I'm writing my story 140 characters at a time, and it's, you know, as you find things out, you know, well, and also he might play this position, and also they got this player back, and I remember there was one trade last year where I think there were five players involved, and five different people had one of the players, you know, which seemed ridiculous, you know, that people are competing over what was the third minor leaguer in this trade, you know, and calling, you know, somebody's farm director to find out. But, Jen, have you experienced sort of similar frustrations in this?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I was going to add to that is just that I think when you, especially as the trade deadline's approaching and you kind of, you know, these nuggets are going to come out from Ken Rosenthal's and John Heyman's and John Morosi types, I think the one thing that kind of I've learned over the last few years is that everyone's going to start, you know, if you follow baseball beat writers, any kind of news that breaks, you're going to see like a million tweets in a row. And I think if you're kind of taking the approach where you're going to step away from Twitter for half a second and put up a really quick blog post that's like, who is this guy that the Sox was traded for? That's something that a reader can click on instead of just reading a tweet. So, I mean, I think it definitely, you know, and it doesn't have to be, you know, 10,000 words long. It maybe is like three sentences, and you know, you'll probably, you know, can look that information up on Baseball Reference really quick and just have some content for the reader to kind of look at, and then obviously keep adding to that as you find out more. I think that's kind of something that's you realize is more and more important instead of you know, kind of just breaking these little snippets, you know, as Twitter kind of comes along.
So you've stepped away from Twitter?
I mean, haven't stepped away from Twitter. Well,
what's that like? Is that,
but it's hard to step away.
Can I just give my trade story today? I get out of the shower and somebody had retweeted a story written about Wilkerson from, like, I don't know, April. And I was like, why did they retweet this? And then I, you know, I see what happens because I wasn't on Twitter in the shower. It's one of the few places you can't be on Twitter. And I text Jason Mastrodano, my beat partner. I was like, hey, man, did you see this? And I hadn't checked his Twitter yet. He's like, yeah, I'm on a conference call with Dave Nebraska right now. I'm like, oh, okay. But that's what happens. I mean, you literally will step in the shower, and there's a new player on the Red Sox. So that was my 7 o'clock hour tonight.
All right, where's our next question? I'm trying to find it.
No follow-ups about Evan's shower.
Oh. Good. Where's the mic? Over here.
Second round. Appreciate more than pulling spring bottles up there. A little mystery cup from Dan Shaughnessy and a brown bottle from Mr. Spear. You'd think, given the Astros history coverage, you'd have more than nothing in front of you. Given the pre-mentioned cesspool online and everything, and that was more related to really the fans and the media, but given the players' relationship versus the media, how do you feel like the Twitter coverage has really kind of changed that? And do you feel like you guys get maybe a little bit more leeway when you're reporting versus like hard takes against players? Or do you feel like given days or even maybe years later, players taking stance against you for hard take stories against them?
You know, for me, Twitter's made it worse because it's easier to take a tweet out of context. So you'll say something about a player, you know, why he's not playing that day, or a bad stat about that player. And then invariably what the player says is, I didn't read it, but somebody told me you tweeted that, because they never actually read it, of course. And you have to explain, well, you know, I actually later on wrote this in my story that, you know, explaining why that is. And to me, Twitter's made it harder because the players tend to read social media more than they would read your entire story.
So they're picking out the parts they don't like and maybe giving you a hard time about it. And at least in my experience, you spend a lot of time explaining, you know, well, if you had actually read the whole thing, this is what I meant. And a lot of times they don't want to hear that. They just, you know, they're upset about the certain tweet. But for me, yeah, for me, social media has not helped at all with players, other than I think it allows them to know who you are better maybe than when you just had a byline.
I have one little Twitter thing from spring training. It was Easter. Pete was taking a rare day off or working special section, whatever. So I was the beat guy that day, and the Pablo stuff was, you know, pretty critical mass at that point. They claimed he had a bad back. We thought they were trying to bury him. Who knew? All the stuff was happening. So he came in, and he was by himself, and I went over to his locker, and I said, good morning, Pablo. How's the back? And he said, please go away. Happy Easter. And I thought, you know, so I'm like, yeah, happy Easter to you, too. So I went up, and I tweeted that, because that's what you do now. I'm like, you know, morning on the beat, you know. And I do the me, Pablo, him, the whole thing. And like, you know, another day on the beat, no big deal. And an hour later, the PR guy of the Red Sox is chasing me down. He says, Dan, Pablo says he didn't say, please go away. You know, he said, by the way, you know. Well, he's really hard to understand. You know, he's Venezuelan. He tries real hard. He's a very polite guy. So I had a tape, I listened to it again. And, you know, yeah, he says, I'm so used to people telling me to fuck off. I just assumed, you know, that he was saying, you know. So I was like, so I felt bad. I you know, undid the tweet, but, you know, the damage is done. Then I sent another thing and said, you know, unfair to Pablo. This is what he really said. And I went down to him later and I said, ah, Pablo, that was really unfair. Sorry. I just figured you would tell me to go screw. You know, it's like a thing. So he was, it's good. But that's what can happen.
Evan, how has social media kind of changed your interaction with players?
I got into a Twitter fight with another media member last year, right before the playoffs, the Astros wild card game at Yankee Stadium. And like three players come up to me and like, hey, what's going on, man? Like Carlos Correa was like, I got to talk to you. And I was like, what the hell did I write about Carlos Correa that's going to piss him off? The guy, you know, he was about to win the Rookie of the Year. And he just wanted to talk to me about this Twitter fight because it was a spectacle for him. Like he had seen this before. So, look, they know
what's... Sorry.
We've made up. They do see it, and I hope most of them can kind of have an understanding of it. The broader issue that I wrestle with and still think about, and it's a little better for me at the Herald because it's more clearly defined that I write... I will write columns, and I will also write more straight news stories. But that line is very blurred, and Twitter... It's totally blurred, right? I mean, it's analysis. And where is that line between analysis and opinion? Is there actually any functional line there? Do people understand when what I'm writing is a true column, which is an opinion piece, versus, you know, what the facts say, right? You'll get people emailing or tweeting at you about you know, what's happening as though, like, I'm advocating for it happening. No, this is just the news of the day. But I don't know how easily... that's discerned from fans, and it, frankly, the way it is set up doesn't make it easy to be discerned.
Can we get into a Twitter fight? That would be good. We can.
You and me?
Yeah, that would be generate some you know, views and stuff.
Clicks?
Yeah, that'd be awesome, yeah. All right, let's have time for one more question. I can't see where the micro... Oh, it's over here. Okay, let's make it a good one.
Back to some actual baseball. You guys, just being around the team all the time, going into the trade deadline, over the past couple years, obviously we know we need starting pitching. A year or two ago, we probably could have gotten Cole Hamels if we'd given up Betts and Bogarts. Do you see the team willing to mortgage the future with Yoan Moncada or Andrew Benintendi for a starting pitcher?
That's a very good question, and we were talking about that backstage. I think having Betts, Bradley, and Bogarts on the roster every day, it allows them to maybe trade a younger guy, knowing that they have this core of good young players and that they're not giving away the future. I can't envision them trading Moncada. They've got $63 million wrapped up in him. And I think it would be hard to trade Benintendi, too. This seems like a guy who's got a chance to be a special player. Beyond that, I think, you know, given what they have offensively, I think they could trade anybody beyond those two guys and do what they can to try to win this year. Because, frankly, of David Ortiz. I mean, I think Ortiz's last that bat needs to be in the playoffs, frankly.
I think that they would
I think that they are reluctant to trade either Moncada and Benintendi, but what we know from the Dave Dombrowski MO is that there is no one who is quote-unquote off limits. That said, there's a history lesson. 2007, in Dave Dombrowski's tenure with the Tigers, he did not make a deal at the trade deadline. They were up, I think, 4 games at the trade deadline. They ended up losing by a number of games to the Indians. And that offseason, he ended up using a player who a lot of teams have been interested in, Cameron Maybin, as the means of acquiring Miguel Cabrera. So I think that there is a willingness to deal absolutely anyone, but the return has to be sufficient to justify the caliber of talent. I think that Benintendi and Moncada are viewed as being like in a kind of special class of Red Sox prospects that would require the like Jose Fernandez's of the world and, you know, in the truly elite players of the world in return. And then beyond that, you can have a conversation. I think that come the offseason, it's, you know, you can then maybe think about Moncada, Benintendi. For Pete's reason, I think it's really hard for them to trade Moncada now that they already have $63 million wrapped up in that guy. I think that that's a much harder thing to explain to, like, ownership and ownership partners and all that stuff.
What's your trade deadline strategy, Jen? What do you got?
The one thing I was going to add is, you know, we don't have a ton of, you know, background with Dombrowski here with the Red Sox and kind of how he'll operate in obviously this deadline, but he did trade 4 prospects for Craig Kimbrell last December. So, you know, it's not that he's unwilling to trade the prospects, and we've heard that, you know, we've gotten the impression that Benintendi and Moncada are kind of off the table more or less unless, you know, the doors are open on any guy and any ace they can get. But, you know, the Sox farm system is so deep at this point. You know, you have guys like Dubon, Devers, Kopech. You've got Anderson Espinosa. I mean, who knows if that's someone that they might be maybe wavering on if they want to trade. But there's a lot of other pieces aside from Moncada and Benintendi that they can work with. And you know, the two of the guys they traded for Kimbrel last year are going to be joining Benintendi and Moncada at the Futures All-Star Game, Manuel Margot and Carlos Islaje. So, I mean, those are two pretty good guys that they gave up. I mean, this will be a really interesting, you know, 3 to 4 weeks to see what he does and kind of how he operates with this pool of talent that he has.
Evan, we'll leave the last word for you. What do you think will happen with the trade deadline?
I have to put myself on the line here. They're going to get a starting pitcher. There's absolutely no question about that. And my guess would be that they do not end up trading those two because there's just not going to be that type of player available that Alex is talking about. I was talking to another GM recently, and I just, you know, it was an on background conversation. I asked him, you know, do you think he's Dombrowski going all in here? And the look was like, yeah, like there's no. He's here for this reason. He's here for win now. That has been immediacy has been the projected message. But I think, like, if you synthesize the question, and maybe I'm misinterpreting the question, but it comes down to, is Dombrowski willing to undervalue these guys just to get somebody in the short term? And I believe the answer is no. Those kids are on the table, as Alex said, if the right deal comes along. I don't think Dombrowski is in a position where he's going to do something stupid. It is probably the bottom line for me.
What a ringing endorsement. I don't think he'll do anything stupid either. But I think we're all going to be working a lot during that time, and I think clearly they're going to get, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, they're going to get a starting pitcher. It wouldn't shock me to see them get some kind of setup guy too. And given their offense, you know, to some degree, I think they're almost obligated to do that because they have to give these guys a chance to do something. And with what they have right now, I don't think they would have a chance. So
Calhoun left field?
Yeah, why not? Absolutely. Anyway, that's this part of the program. We have one more segment left. I want to thank Dan, Jen, Evan, and Alex for doing this. Please read Jen and Mass Live, Evan and the Herald, meet Dan and Alex in the Globe. Thank you.
This podcast was recorded live from the Wilbur Theater in Boston, Massachusetts. Check out our upcoming shows in San Francisco, Chicago, Toronto. Head on over to pitchtalksbaseball.com. And also give us some love, some ratings on iTunes. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time.